Hi, I'm Ann DeLisi.
And I'm Chef James Regatto.
And today we're talking with State Senator Mallory McMurrow. She joins us to talk about how the state government and the restaurant industry were forced to come together when the COVID-19 pandemic hit and reflect on what worked and what didn't. We also talked about how climate change and protecting the Great Lakes ecosystem affects our food supply here in Michigan.
All right, so we have State Senator Mallory McMurrow of Royal Oak with us today. And while I don't know how great you are in the kitchen at cooking, I do know that you have quite a bit of experience with the restaurant industry from the state side that we dealt with for the last 2.5 years with shutdowns and restrictions and the MLCC and indoor-outdoor masks and all the chaos that ensued during that time. And I wanted to have you on the show today because I can say that while I think many restaurants felt either shoved aside or confused or neglected or mismanaged, you were probably the only politician that reached out to me or was available. And we actually met on the patio at Maple Gray during that time with the simple conversation of how can I help? Where are you hurting? What do you need? And even if things were changing so rapidly, we couldn't create real policy or anything. You were an ear and you cared and you went and applied some of that towards conversations with, fellow government officials. So I wanted to kind of pick up where we left off with, the food system's broken. The restaurant system is recovering, but still struggling. And I think there's reflections of that probably in the city, state, and national government. And international governing communities as well. So without being too broad, I just wanted to kind of check in and see what your take on the restaurant industry, where we're going, what went wrong, what went right, and just kind of take your pulse on where things are from your perspective in the government.
Yeah, and I'm glad to be here. And I will say, first of all, my husband is a much better cook than I am, but I go way back in the industry. So I was a bartender. I got my bartending license in New Jersey at 18, because that's something that you can do. Worked in restaurants through college, so it's always been something I'm really passionate about. I love restaurants. And the entire experience of the pandemic and, we're coming out, hopefully on the other side of it, we know a lot more now. But I think looking back, I tried to do exactly what you said, reach out and just talk to as many people as possible. And I think that if there's any parallels between the challenges of the restaurant industry and government, it's that we just don't do enough of that. There just aren't enough sit down conversations. How are you doing? How are you feeling? What do you need? Instead of this retreating to your camp. And COVID was a perfect example of, I don't necessarily know that anybody was right. Everybody was trying to make the best decisions with all of the information we had in real time. And history is going to tell how that went. I know that when I was taking a look at where we were at in Michigan, Harvard was publishing a lot of really good documentation on what happened during the 1918 flu pandemic, and that there was consistent research that said that cities that implemented stricter restrictions early on recovered much faster. And I think that that was at least my hope early on, but now we're 2.5 years later, and hopefully we've learned a lot about how we continue to operate and thrive and fix things that were broken.
Is there anything that you saw then that you look back and, in the last 2.5 years, was there any, thing that you're like, that was completely a disaster? Like, was there anything you would go back and change?
I mean, I think everything was just moving so fast. And I remember when the state was shifting towards, okay, outdoor structures were allowed, but restaurants were moving faster than the state departments could put out clear, cohesive guidelines about what that meant. So I had conversations, some were arguments, with restaurant owners who had spent a lot of money building outdoor structures, but that didn't solve the issue of air circulation, which was what we were learning was really how COVID spread, was not surfaces. I just remember back to when we were getting groceries delivered and like washing them before bringing them into our house, which was wild that we all lived through that. But that was, if anything, I think government is slow. And I came from the private sector before running for office for the first time in 2018. And it's really tough to to be at the pace that the restaurant industry needed to go with clear guidelines and getting to a place where a lot of these outdoor structures had no windows, no ventilation, no circulation. And it would have actually been better to be indoors with the HVAC systems that we had, but we just didn't know that at the time. And I know that that was a really frustrating pain point for a lot of restaurant owners.
Yeah, I think too, it's interesting because, you know, we were somebody, my restaurant, Mabel Gray, we stayed open the whole time. So there's a handful of us that were, you know, from day one. I think She Wolf was probably the earliest. I mean, I feel like they were like open, you know, they shut down for maybe like 12 hours and then they were like a grocery store. but a lot of, you know, there's a lot of tenacity in restaurant owners that stayed open. And you know, I was really impressed and inspired and at the level it took to stay open. And, but at the same time, you look at cities like Miami, right, which never shut down and they have good weather. They have things on their side. But now you look at like Michelin is in Florida. Miami is like a super city. The real estate's booming. You know, now you got a celebrity in Ron DeSantis. Like it's interesting to look at cities and states that stayed open and cities and states that shut down. And yeah, I mean, I think you're right. We're all going to learn a lot. And, you know, nobody had a crystal ball, but it's peculiar to see that from a business owner's perspective. And I'm not saying anything should have happened differently because I agree. I mean, I responded to every transition. And I remember there was, you know, local Michigan restaurant owners trying to like, you know, form a militia and stay open. And there's a lot of silly things going on. I just wanted to respond and do whatever you tell me to do. Not you, but, you know, the governing bodies. And, you know, what is that from your perspective when you see cities that stayed open and thrived and you see cities, you know, is that, how do you wrestle with that? Because it's probably ammunition for like, you know, your rivals or people running against you. It's like, there's a lot of the business sector definitely bleeds into the government sector with like, how do you navigate that? You know, what do you see from your perspective now? Should we have stayed open? Is there too many variables to be, it's not cut and dry?
Yeah, I think that's probably a little too binary. And what I appreciate about Mabel Gray and some other restaurants, and I think there's a parallel between restaurants and government, right? There were some restaurants who really saw what was happening and tried to innovate and tried to do new things and tried to figure out how to stay open safely, how to do. I took one of your cooking classes when I was extremely pregnant, which gave me something good to do when I was stuck at home. And then we had some restaurant owners who just didn't and wanted to sue the government, right? And I think that I have colleagues who operate sort of in the same mentality. There's some of us who I really admire who want to get creative. And it wasn't a magic wand, but I introduced the first versions of cocktails to go in social districts to say, how can we create safer outdoor spaces? How can we provide at least a small revenue stream for restaurants who want to, versus some who were just like, it's the way we've always done it or nothing.
Yeah.
And I think that there are definitely ways in Michigan. I mean, we're not Miami. We're not warm. It doesn't work. Although having visited New York, just the balls of New Yorkers to sit outside in like 6 inches of snow and still eat is something I think that's admirable. I don't know that I would want to do that necessarily in Michigan, but I think it's how can we be more nimble to adopt creative solutions? And that goes both ways, right? Mm-hmm. That's business owners and government, I think, hopefully working better together to say what's going to work in our state, what's going to work in our regions, what's going to work for our constituents, and then what's standing in the way of that happening. And those were, you know, the two examples of legislation that I put up. Again, didn't solve everything,
no, but
it was creative.
Those are great. I mean, those were the things at the time, those were life rafts when you're like cocktails to go. I mean, you know, that was something that was like, you know, yeah, it would have made sense to roll that out in the middle of March, you know, like, hey, we're shutting down, but you can do this.
Right.
So, and yeah, you're right. Government runs slow, but no, those were huge things. Even now with like, you know, essentially the beer, self-serve beer laws that just passed.
Yes.
Like there's a lot of good things that have come out, you know, of the government pivoting. I definitely feel like people like you, I'm happy you're in government because we can have conversations. And I feel like I'm like, oh, wow, look, this law passed. That's a solution. And I agree. I mean, I wrote an op-ed for the Free Press during this about, okay, there's a little bit too much, you know, sitting on your hands and complaining, like just innovate, be creative. You know, the public was wonderful. I mean, the cooking classes you mentioned, like every time we pivoted, there was a line of people ready to receive it. And not every restaurant was that lucky, but I think that the public was more flexible than people gave them credit for. But yeah, I think that, you know, pandemic was just all the things that existed, like the problems in government, the problems in food were always there.
Yeah.
The pandemic just really just put a spotlight and just those cracks became, you know, voids.
Well, and I hope that for my colleagues in government, you know, the thing that I tell people who are advocating for issues or the things they are concerned about all the time is you have to recognize that your elected official has to know a little bit about everything.
Yeah.
And we all have our own area of expertise, but that's very different. I mean, you're an expert in a way I'm never going to be in running and operating a restaurant, in the food system and what's broken in it. So that's why I do things like trying to reach out, because I want to learn so that I can be an advocate for those things. Some of my best bills that I'm most proud of are things that constituents have brought to me directly and said, I've identified a problem, here's a solution, will you introduce it? And if we can open up more of that dialogue where it's less about winning, you know, the idea of the culture of politics is all about winning or losing, and you have to pick your side and you have to fight it out. And at the end of the day, I think you were exactly right that we all want restaurants that we love. We all want communities that we love. We all want the same thing. How can we tear down some of that tribalism so that we can actually have those honest conversations and not attack somebody if they have an idea that doesn't work for the industry, right? Because it's not saying like you're wrong and you should be out, but making space for let's all learn about each other. And that gives me more capability as an elected official to offer up things that are going to be real solutions and not, you know, surface level ideas that don't actually fix anything.
Yeah. And, you know, and not to stir the pot, but I think things that stung for restaurants too was like, you saw certain, you know, there's rules in place, right? No more than six people, indoor, outdoor, spacing, masking. And then you see people in leadership gathering in spaces,
yeah.
You know, whether it's locally or Gavin Newsom doing, you know, French Laundry, like, you know, that is kind of where I think, you know, the haves and the have nots, that the divide only grows. So while I totally agree with your perspective, I think that that's an interesting thing to, you know, I imagine from your perspective that has to feel like two steps backwards when moments like that happen.
Oh, it does. I got pregnant during the pandemic. We were so careful, I think probably more so than most people, about I didn't go anywhere except to the Capitol because we didn't know what was going to happen if a pregnant woman got COVID. We just didn't know anything about it. So it always, I did all of my live streams from my house. I tried to keep up with constituents. I tried to call people. And anytime I saw any elected official breaking the rules for their convenience, I'm just like, come on.
Yeah.
Like this, we all have to be in this together. And there has to be a recognition that those of us in these roles, you have to lead by example as well, not just put rules out and say, okay, this is the safest thing, but I'm going to do something else. I mean, we saw what happened in the UK, like
right.
That dam broke because
right.
At some point people are sick of it if you break your own rules.
Yeah. I was in Ireland during watching that live, you know, it's just like, you know, and Ireland, especially with Brexit and Northern
yeah.
Ireland, it's just like the hot mess that's going on over there. Yeah, I mean, it's, and this isn't you know, special to Michigan or to the U.S. I mean, the whole world right now is kind of having a reckoning. Look at Italy right now.
Yeah.
The whole world is having a reckoning on how people want to be governed and how the world is. And I think all these problems have always been there. COVID was really just this, like the new, you know, the new agitator.
Yeah. And I think it pushed it all to the forefront. And this is going to sound really nerdy, I put together a PowerPoint presentation in my first year in office about how beyond any single policy, our biggest issue is trust right now. There is no trust in government. You know, government ranks below lawyers and like, you know, basically we're last. And we're never going to get to a place where we can go through a crisis and come out the other side okay, if we don't rebuild that trust. And we saw that, you know, Michigan, not a proud accomplishment. We were the first state in the country to have a major COVID protest. On April 15th was the traffic jam protest. April 30th was the armed storming of our Capitol. And when you saw four armed gunmen in the gallery in that photo, what you don't see is right below them is me, because we were there. And it's like living in a fishbowl. And that's sort of what's terrifying to me. And COVID was just, it unleashed all of it because there was so much anger and we haven't done the work previously to rebuild that trust. We have to if we're ever going to get back to a place where we're on the same team.
Yeah.
And how do you do that?
I mean, I can only operate in my small bubble in the world.
Yeah.
So what we try to do, you know, I host a weekly live stream
mm-hmm.
every single week that the Senate is in session where we share what's going on in the state, what's going on in the legislature, and then we do live Q&A, and it's on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. I try to be really available. I try to call people who don't like me is a nice way to put it. A constituent called me, I'm not even going to say it on air, but a tyrannical C word. And my husband had it made into a candle. So it was just like, you take the hits at some point. But
did you talk to that person?
I did.
How did that go?
Not great. I had this attitude really early on in the pandemic that people are just really angry and they want to vent. And if I can be that punching bag, then fine. So my poor staff, they told me not to, but I was calling a lot of people back who didn't genuinely want to engage. And this particular conversation, you know, this was a man who called the governor Hitler and said that we were all tyrants and this is just like the Holocaust. And I had to stop him at some point and say, you are welcome to air your grievances and express any frustration with me. That's all fine. But we don't tolerate anti-Semitism, especially because my husband is Jewish. Mm-hmm. And his response to me was, you are the exact person who killed your husband's family in the Holocaust.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And that's when I kind of stopped calling everybody back and recognized there are just some people who don't want to engage with you and they just want somebody to punch. And that's not, it's not my job. It's not my staff's job. But we try to kind of not overcompensate, but create more opportunities for people to hear from me directly. Throughout COVID, as we kind of figured out gathering outside was a safer thing to do, we started doing what we called precinct potlucks, where we found a neighbor throughout the district who would offer up their driveway and we would canvass the neighborhood and just say, hey, I'm going to be here in a week. Come out and meet me one-on-one. And we got really small groups. And it was great because there were neighbors who had never even met their neighbors, but they got the flyers and said, this is a cool opportunity. I've never met my state senator.
Was there actually food there? You called it a
There pot. Was. Okay. Yeah. We said on the flyer, like, we brought food. Okay. I brought food, but also asked, like, hey, bring something to share if you're willing to.
What was the best thing you ate on the potluck tour?
Oh, the best thing I ate on the potluck tour. I mean, it was all like regular finger food.
Oh, but I get it.
Anytime.
You know, somebody came out flexing though.
Oh, yeah. Anytime I'm in Troy and people bring samosas, I'm just like, oh, I am very excited about this.
That's fair.
Pretty great. That seems like something that not all state senators do. You are forging your own path that way. And to have those conversations that I'm sure you knew were not going to be fun and most likely not productive. But there have to be those wins every once in a while for you where you actually have a conversation where each side learns a little something and people get to see your side as well. Were there those moments that made you more hopeful and maybe develop some trust that you're hoping?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we get that type of positive feedback all the time, especially on things like our live streams where so many people have emailed and said, I am completely opposite from you on the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you do that and you explain your positions and I feel like I know who you are, I really respect that. And I think that's the best type of feedback we can have. And I've even had people say, I'll vote for you because I know where you are on things. You know, I don't feel like you're hiding anything from me. And that's hopefully the goal.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
What, and related to food and obviously agriculture, to me, restaurants are a part of agriculture. We're the end of the line, essentially. You know, what do you think right now is one of the more pressing things going on in the agricultural community that people aren't aware of? Is there anything that's, you know, that's that you're worried about or that you're excited about or law that's coming? Like, what is going on behind the scenes in the agricultural community that you think more people need to know about?
I mean, there's so many small bills I move that I think are important. So we just passed a bill that basically incentivizes local distillers if they use at least 40% Michigan-made products, which is, you know, supporting both local distillers in the state and hopefully providing an incentive to support more of our farmers within the state. That's just one thing that we can help. But I am very concerned about the impacts of climate change on Michigan, and I am devastated by the political gridlock right now because I work with colleagues who, frankly, don't even want to acknowledge it, and they're some of the same colleagues who represent more of the outstate agricultural areas. That is why we need those voices. That's why we need you to advocate and show up and say, this is how it's affecting my day-to-day life, because we need all of my colleagues to hear and understand that.
Now, what about the Great Lakes, right? Because the Great Lakes are obviously, we view them as Michigan lakes, but they're not. They're basically a regional product. We share borders with many states, Canada.
Right.
I guess for me, I'm naive because I look at the lakes like Michigan's problem and our asset, but they're essentially affected by two international governments.
Yep.
But I'm assuming the federal government has more impact than the local government does statewide for the Great Lakes.
It's a combination of both. And it was really interesting when I ran for office for the first time. I mean, I consider myself an environmentalist, but I talked to voters who align on the other side of the aisle who view the Great Lakes as a national security issue. Because as we look at climate change, you know, I had a woman who asked me where I was at on water because she thought clean water was going to be the cause of the next world war. And we are sitting on a tremendous asset as we see droughts around the country and around the world that a lot of other regions simply don't have. So it's a combination of both. So within the state level, we are pushing legislation related to PFAS cleanup and remediation, making sure that there are actual real penalties for some of these consistent polluters who are leaching these chemicals into the Great Lakes with frankly no consequence. I think that's one of the most terrifying things to me is there are very little kind of sticks or carrots that actually exist if you've got one single bad actor company who just avoids fines for decades and then they go under. A perfect example was the green ooze that we saw on 696 coming out of Madison Heights that gets into our water system.
Right by my house.
And it was a very visible example because, you know, that pipe burst and it was winter. So you saw this lime green.
Because you see it.
You see it.
And it exists. I mean, like things like this are happening all the time.
They're happening all the time.
But they're not necessarily always oozing onto your morning commute.
So that was, I mean, that is one example of something that happens around our communities and around our state all the time is that there are companies who don't take responsibility. And this isn't a knock on every company because there are a lot of companies who are great corporate citizens. But that is something that I'm watching now is why don't we have stronger regulation tools where you can't just avoid paying fines for decades. And then it's what taxpayers' responsibility to clean it up. So making sure that we have stronger polluter pay laws we have more in place. I didn't realize until I got into this job that 80% of dams are privately owned. So when we saw the Midland Dam collapse, that's another example of this is not public infrastructure. It's a private single person owning this dam who did not do the maintenance, who did not do the upkeep, and it created a catastrophe.
Yeah.
And that is a major red flag for me, not even just around Michigan, but around the country, is how much privately owned infrastructure is on the verge of collapse. And that's got to be a partnership between states and the federal government.
And the wild thing is, like, you know, I think for the average person just hearing these stories, it probably sounds like it's, you know, jargon in the government world. But to me, when I hear PFAS, Great Lakes, freshwater supply, I think of agriculture, farm, like land that can no longer be farmed because it's contaminated,
right.
You know, water supply, you know, you look at Flint, you look at, you know, the Great Lakes I mean, how much lake fish? I mean, you know, not only is that an ecosystem, but it's also a huge food source for so many people. You look at, I mean, in the UP, whether it's, you know, wild rice or, you know, maple trees or, you know, coastal communities, like it, the Great Lakes are not just this, you know, disconnected idea. It's a part of our everyday life. I mean, you look at the water table in Grosse Pointe and the Detroit canals. And we are very much, isolated by some things in global warming, but we can't really afford for the lake levels to rise very much. And obviously a big threat is to, you know, to have them go down. Or, you know, I know that I've talked to a few friends, Nick Schreck, who's a professor over at Wayne State. He's a good friend of mine. And I asked him because I'm like, how have they not proposed a pipeline? Because this is a fear of mine. It's like, somebody's got to have a pipeline proposed to the Colorado aquifer, basically, you know, to pump water. Nick claims they have drawings from the 50s, basically, but they didn't have the power at the time to pipe the water out. And I've seen some like, you know, theories out there online, because I've always had this like looming fear that someone's going to build a pipeline and run it along the highway and pump it into the Colorado River.
Yeah.
I mean, is this, are these crazy ideas? Is this something that you think that like would spur a civil war? I mean, how crazy is conversations like that?
I mean, I don't think it's crazy at all. You just look at some of the unrest in the Middle East right now. And if a majority of people get to a point where they do not have basic needs, food, water, good paying jobs, there is rightfully huge unrest. So if we do get to a place in this country, and I watch in some of the regions that get water out of the Colorado River right now, are planning for and approving developments for water they don't have. And that is devastating to me, thinking about, you know, again, we as Michigan, the Great Lakes are not entirely ours, but we are one of the stewards of it. What is that going to mean for us when the Colorado River runs dry and they're looking for something else?
Right.
How do we participate in that in a way that is not going to hurt our own residents and our agriculture? And it's not crazy. It's something that we have to think about because it's very real. And that's one of my, I was not surprised, but deeply angry that the climate funding got cut out of the federal negotiations, because it's no longer a hypothesis. It's happening, and it's happening right now. And we have to plan for it. I think, and I know Nick well too, we have to realize that it's a twofold problem. We have to mitigate our accelerating impact to climate change, but also plan for the changing climate. It's not one or the other. We don't have to look any farther than the flooding that we saw last summer, devastating Metro Detroit, closing highways, flooding people's basements, losing everything, to realize we have to build things differently because this is the new reality.
Yeah. I mean, I had two cooks that lost their cars that night, you know, literally totaled vehicles. And when I think about food, restaurants, agriculture, I mean, it all comes down to water. I mean, obviously we know that water is the source of life, but you look at the, you know, Southwest, you look at Southern California. I mean, this is a huge production area for a lot of the food that we eat, right? You know, Mexico, I mean, they produce a lot of what we consume in America. I mean, a lot of my menu, even in peak season, you can't avoid, you know, almonds, olives, you know, lettuces, iceberg. I mean, there's just so much that comes out of this area that to think of it going dry, I mean, you're losing a huge percentage of the food that we grow. And you look at what's happening in Ukraine and how that's choking the global food supply.
Well, and just how much of it is tainted now too. If I can provide one example that I'm really, really proud of, is the amount of plastics that end up in our water supply that end up in fish. Cranes last year, you know, did a devastating report that a few decades ago, there were no microplastics in fish. Now, if you eat the average fish coming out of the Great Lakes, there's dozens of pieces of microplastics, which never leave your body, that end up in their food supply, that end up in our food supply. So I have one constituent who, when she was 14, recognized that this was a problem. She just started high school. She reached out to researchers at the University of Michigan, grad students, and came to me with an entire presentation on, I understand this is an issue, here's one solution I have for it. And her solution was banning intentional release of balloons, which multiple other states have done already, adding it to our litter law. And she was like, again, this is not going to solve everything. But she had actually tracked how many pieces of plastic balloon debris have ended up in the Great Lakes every year. And it's not in, you know, it's not inconsistent. It's a fairly sizable amount for one source of plastic. So I introduced that bill. And that's a perfect example of, this is an issue that impacts all of us. There are people, I represent 280,000 people. People are experts in everything, or will become experts in everything. There are great ideas out there. And that's the relationships we should be building, to put up really simple, straightforward ideas that can help fix these issues.
No, it's wonderful. And I think if every person in local government was doing that, right?
Yeah.
There's 10 million people in Michigan, right?
Isn't that, yes.
Yeah, yep. There's 10 million people in the state of Michigan. You represent 280,000 of them. If every single official was putting forward, if everyone was getting rid of the, you know, the balloon, then we wouldn't have as many problems as we do in the Great Lakes.
Yeah.
So one thing, when we sat down during the pandemic, we sat down on the patio at Mabel Gray and talked about a few ideas. And one of them was Pure Michigan working more to promote restaurants or industries, food industries affected by COVID, specifically because I look at Michigan in the last 10 years specifically restaurants are a huge draw, right? You look at, you know, anchor tenants, you look at Detroit's development, Ann Arbor, Traverse City. I mean, these tourism, you know, meccas rely on restaurants. You stay at a hotel, you want to get a bite to eat. You look at San Murillo, you look at, you know, you look at Trattoria Stella up in Traverse City, you know, you look at the beer community in Grand Rapids. I mean, if you take away restaurants and bars, you know, what is Pure Michigan advertising for? I mean, just what, just the, you know, some shoulder seasons, a little 3 months of beach, you know, 2 months of skiing. We need these industries. And, you know, you had a lot of great ideas and things that you were working on. I would like you to share them with me.
Yeah, I think, and I've lived in 5 states. I travel all the time. I think that Michigan, especially right now, has one of the most exciting food and drink scenes in the entire country. Super creative. We're so diverse. And I don't think we do enough to celebrate and promote that. I mean, that is something that would draw not only people from one side of Michigan to the other, but people from all around the country and all around the world. Come experience, you know, a food vacation or a beer vacation or a wine vacation. And we don't do that enough. So I would love to see some more production go into that. I think we've seen, and this is off on a tangent, but F1 gained so many followers when they did a Netflix series and they understood the power of content to draw fans into following Formula One who never have before. I mean, it is the best example of content driving real results. And I would love to see us do that. Let's put some content out about all of the great things that you guys are doing, about all of the really interesting things that our farmers are doing and, you know, the cherry season, all of it. And I think it would be huge. So I've been in the ears of those who run Pure Michigan and the MEDC to say, let's do that more.
I don't know if the average person understands that's a state-run organization. So Pure Michigan is not like, you know, just fun for media. This is state run.
Right. Yeah. It is our official state. It's in our state budget tourism campaign. And it is, when I travel the country and I talk to legislators from other states, I mean, we are the envy of other states because you see billboards in New York, you see them in California, and it touts a lot of our outdoor recreation, which is beautiful. It's wonderful. Let's expand on that.
Right.
And I think that's a really powerful way to promote and buoy an industry that did get hit and hit hard throughout COVID to celebrate it.
Well, the thing is, if you go skiing or, you know, snowmobiling or swimming, whatever you're doing,
you have to eat. Yeah.
And then, you know, chances are you want to drink and you want staying in a cool hotel somewhere. It's all connected. And I think that, you know, the restaurant scene is the backbone of tourism.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm really happy to hear that you're working on that, because I think that that's a great way to spend the money that Pure Michigan receives, and they've done a great job. But I think that, you know, pivoting a little bit to shine a spotlight on these restaurants and areas that are affected would be, seems like it would be in line with everything else you've been working on.
Absolutely.
Our thanks to State Senator McMurrow for joining us, and thanks to you for listening, and
we would like to thank La Marca Prosecco for their support. From the hills of Veneto, Italy, you can never go wrong with Prosecco, whether it's in a spritz or drinking straight.
And if you're a fan of our show, there are a few things you can do to support us. Leave us a review, tell a friend about the show, or make a donation to support our station, WDET, Detroit's NPR station. Just go to WDET.org/give. Essential Cooking is produced by me, Ann DeLisi, along with my co-host, James Rigotto. This episode was edited, mixed, and mastered by Sam Bobian, with production support from David Lyons. Original music by the Mallet Brothers. Essential Cooking is a production of WDET, Detroit's NPR station.